It is February 19th, 2026. And if you have been scrolling through the news feeds this week, maybe looking at the clips coming out of the Swiss Alps or, the security halls in Munich, you might have this distinct sinking feeling that the ground isn't just shifting under your feet. It feels like the floorboards are actually snapping.
It's a real vertigo moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
We aren't just watching a news cycle play out. It feels like we are watching a historical pivot point in real time.
Exactly. And usually on this show, we talk about transitions or maybe geopolitical shifts. We use these polite, soft words.
Right.
But the sources we are looking at today, I mean, the people actually running the world right now, they are using a much more violent word.
They are.
They are calling this a rupture.
Rupture is the word of the week. And it's such a visceral term. It implies that something that was holding the world together, a tendon, a contract, maybe a shared story, has snapped.
And it's not going to heal back the way it was.
No, it's a permanent break.
So, to help us figure out if we're just hitting a massive pothole in the road of history, or if the wheels are actually coming off the bus entirely, we have pulled together a stack of sources that are, well, honestly, they're heavy.
They are.
We aren't just looking at the headlines today. We are bringing in a diagnostic lens.
We're trying to do something a bit ambitious. We're going to look at the political reality of 2026, specifically two huge speeches that just dropped this week. And then we're going to layer over that some deep structural analysis from philosophy and peace research.
So we're doing the what and the why.
Precisely. For the what, we have Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
And on the other side.
And then we have U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, fresh into the second Trump administration, delivering what you can only call a fire and brimstone speech at the Munich Security Conference.
Two very different vibes there. The calm central banker versus the political crusader.
Totally. And then for the why, the diagnostic part, we have two intellectual heavy hitters. Johann Galtung, who's basically the father of peace research.
Okay.
And John McMurtry, a philosopher who specializes in what he calls the ruling group mind.
The ruling group mind. That sounds ominous.
And a fair warning to you listening. McMurtry and Galtung, they go deep. I mean, they talk about the psychopathology of nations and the cancer stage of capitalism.
So this is not your standard political commentary where we just analyze poll number.
Not at all. This is the deep dive.
It's the red pill. We're going down the rabbit hole.
In a way, yes. So the mission today is to ask, are Carney and Rubio fixing a broken world? Are they the doctors rushing to the scene?
Or are they just symptoms? Symptoms of a deeper and, as you said, maybe a cancerous value system?
That's the question on the table.
Okay, let's dive in. Let's start with the greengrocer. This was the centerpiece of Mark Carney's big speech at the WEF just a few days ago. And it felt like a very literary, almost philosophical way to open a trade speech in 2026.
It really was. It was a surprising move. Carney referenced a famous essay by the Czech dissident and later President Vaclav Havel.
The power of the powerless.
That's the one. And honestly, to understand the geopolitics of 2026, you really have to understand this metaphor.
So walk us through it. Why is the Prime Minister of Canada talking about a grocer in a communist country?
Okay, so Havel describes this greengrocer living under communism in the 1970s. Every morning, this man puts a sign in his shop window, right there among the onions and carrots, and the sign says, "Workers of the world, unite."
But does he believe it? Is he like a diehard Marxist revolutionary selling potatoes?
Not at all.
Yeah.
He doesn't believe a word of it. His customers don't believe it. The officials who come by to check the window probably don't even believe it.
So why do it?
He puts it there to signal submission. He puts it there so he doesn't get in trouble. It's a gesture. Havel called this living within a lie. The whole system persisted not because anyone thought it was true, but because everyone performed the ritual. Everyone kept the sign in the window.
And Carney is using this to describe us, the West, the global order.
He's using it to describe the rules-based international order. Carney's whole argument is that for the last 20 years, Western democracies have been that greengrocer.
How so?
We kept putting the sign in the window. The sign that said, "Free trade brings peace," or "Economic integration leads to democracy."
Even though we could see China subsidizing its industries, or we saw the U.S. using sanctions unilaterally, we saw the cracks, but we kept the sign up.
We absolutely saw the cracks. We knew it was partially false. We knew the enforcement was asymmetric. The rules applied to the weak, but not really to the strong.
We played along.
We played along because it was comfortable. It delivered cheap goods. It gave us stable finance, open sea lanes. It was a comfortable lie. It kept the global shop open for business.
But now, Carney says, the sign is down. Someone's taken it out of the window.
That's the rupture. He stood there in front of the Davos crowd and said, quote, "Nostalgia is not a strategy. The pretense is over. We have moved into a world where economic integration isn't seen as a path to peace anymore. It's a weapon."
This is that weaponization of everything concept we keep hearing about.
Yeah.
But he made it very specific, didn't he?
He did. And it's a chilling thought if you really process it. Think about it. If you rely on a rival nation for your energy or for your microchips or your critical minerals,
that isn't a partnership anymore.
In 2026, that is a vulnerability just waiting to be exploited. Carney was very stark about this. He basically said, you cannot be sovereign if your entire economy could be turned off by a switch in Beijing or in Washington.
That's a terrifying thought for any leader, that someone else holds the off switch for your country's economy.
Absolutely.
So Carney is Prime Minister of Canada now, which is a classic middle power. He can't just flip the table like the U.S. or China can. He can't dictate the new rules. So what is his solution to this rupture? How do you survive it?
He calls his strategy value-based realism.
Oh.
It's a strategy for survival when the giants are fighting. And the core mechanism he proposed is something called variable geometry.
Variable geometry? That sounds like a math headache or like an engineering term. What on earth does that mean in diplomacy?
It's actually quite clever, and it's a total departure from the old Cold War mentality.
How so?
Well, in the old world, you had fixed alliances, right?
Mm.
NATO does everything military. The WTO does everything trade. You are basically married to your bloc.
Right. You're team blue or team red.
Variable geometry means you build different shifting coalitions for different problems. You don't marry one partner for life. You date around based on the issue.
Okay, give me a concrete example from the speech. How does this actually work in practice?
Take the Arctic. This is a huge, huge issue for Canada. Carney announced he is doubling Canada's defense spending to put boots on the ice.
Boots on the ice. I like that.
It's a great phrase. He's investing in new submarines, over-the-horizon radar. And for that specific issue, he is locking arms with the Nordics and the U.S. to keep Russia out. That's one geometry. It's a hard security triangle.
But then didn't he pivot to China in the very same speech? That's what caused all the headlines.
He did. Almost in the very next section, he defended what he called a strategic partnership with China on things like clean tech and energy.
Which the U.S., his partner in the Arctic, absolutely hates.
The U.S. loves to hate it. The pressure from Washington to decouple has been immense. But Carney is basically saying, look, we will fight alongside the U.S. in the Arctic to protect our sovereign borders. But we will trade with China on solar panels because we need their technology for our energy transition.
So that's the variable geometry, different partners for different goals.
Exactly. It's an attempt to be sovereign enough to say no to your enemies, but also, and this is the hard part, sovereign enough to say no to your friends when their demands don't suit your national interest.
It sounds like a high wire act. You know, risk management on a global scale. You're trying to keep the U.S. happy enough not to slap you with tariffs while keeping China close enough to buy their batteries.
It is. It's very calm. It's technocratic. It's rational. It's the adult in the room trying to keep the lights on and the house from burning down.
But then
we have to look at the other side of the coin. Because if Carney is the cool-headed architect trying to rebuild, Marco Rubio in Munich was the fire and brimstone preacher telling everyone the old temple needed to be torn down.
This speech was something else. I watched the clip. Rubio stood up at the Munich Security Conference. And, you know, this is usually a pretty buttoned up affair where people talk about interoperability and joint task forces.
Very dry.
And he basically set fire to the entire script.
He declared the end of history to be a dangerous delusion. You remember that idea from the 90s that eventually everyone would just become a liberal democracy and shop at Amazon?
Yeah, the Francis Fukuyama thesis.
Rubio said that wasn't just wrong. He called it a fantasy that actively weakened the West. He said it made us complacent.
He really went after the concept of the global citizen, too.
He shredded it.
Yeah.
He told the Europeans sitting right there in the room that the world has borders, people have distinct national interests, and pretending otherwise is national suicide. He essentially told them, you are not citizens of the world. You are citizens of France, of Germany, of Poland, and your nations are in danger.
And then came the sharpest pivot of all. He went after the climate movement. But he didn't just debate the science or the economics. He framed it as a massive strategic error.
He called it the climate cult. He argued that the West has voluntarily impoverished itself with self-imposed green energy policies while our rivals, China and Russia, burned all the coal and oil they could to build up their industrial muscle.
So for him, a smokestack isn't pollution.
It's power. It's a sign of national vitality. He's framing the entire goal of the second Trump administration as restoration. And he means industrial restoration factories, steel, energy dominance. He wants to see those smokestacks again.
But the part that really struck me, and I think that this is where we need to start pivoting to our deep sources, was the language he used. It wasn't just political. It was almost biblical.
It was explicitly religious. It was a sermon. Rubio invoked divine providence. He talked about 5,000 years of recorded human history. And he linked the U.S. and Europe not by treaties or trade deals, but by Christian faith, blood, and sacrifices.
He called the U.S. a child of Europe.
He did. And that is a massive signal to the world. He is drawing a civilizational circle. He's saying, this is us. Everyone outside of this circle is them.
And what does he demand from the people inside that circle?
Total commitment. He said the U.S. will not be the caretaker of the West's managed decline. That line sent shivers through that room in Munich.
And then the follow-up, decline was a choice. That was the real punch.
Right. So he's demanding that America's allies be proud, sovereign, and capable of fighting. If Carney wants to build a smart fortress made of regulations and trade deals, Rubio wants to build a crusader fortress made of steel and faith.
Okay. So we have the lay of the land in 2026. The rupture is real. The strategies are diverging wildly. We have the technocrat versus the crusader.
A perfect summary.
But now I want to put on those special glasses we promised at the beginning, the diagnostic lens. Because when I hear a Secretary of State talk about divine providence and blood, I feel like we've left the realm of policy and we've entered the realm of psychology.
That is exactly where Johan Galtung comes in. Galtung was a Norwegian sociologist, basically the founder of the entire field of peace and conflict studies. And way back in the 90s, he developed a framework to analyze what he called the psychopathology of nations, specifically the U.S. superpower.
And this framework is the CMT syndrome.
Correct. CMT. It stands for chosenness, myths, and trauma. Galtung argued that these three forces drive foreign policy much more than, say, economics or rational security interests do. He basically put the superpower on the psychoanalyst's couch.
Let's map this onto Rubio's speech, though. Start with C, chosenness.
Okay, so chosenness is the deep-seated, often unconscious belief that your nation is not just a country, but a vehicle for a higher power, that you have a divine mandate.
So when Rubio uses the phrase divine providence and calls the West the greatest civilization in human history, that's what we're talking about.
That is textbook chosenness. It implies you are above the normal laws that govern other nations. If you believe you are on a mission from God, the traffic laws, you know, they don't really apply to you.
The UN Charter doesn't apply to you.
Galtung calls it the hegemon's hegemon. If you are chosen by God, you don't answer to the UN Security Council. You answer to the big boss upstairs. And this creates a sense of righteousness that makes compromise seem like a weakness. You don't compromise with evil, you defeat it.
Okay, that makes sense. Then M for myths.
Myths are the stories we tell ourselves to justify the present and our actions in it. Rubio's speech was just woven with them. He told this romanticized saga of the U.S. You know, he mentioned Italian explorers, Scots-Irish frontiersmen, the cowboy archetype coming from Spain.
It sounds like a movie script. It sounds like a John Ford Western.
That's the entire point. Galtung points out that these national myths usually gloss over the violent reality. Rubio talks about the blank slate of the American frontier, completely ignoring the people who are already living there.
Right.
But politically, the myth is incredibly powerful because it unifies the tribe. It tells people, you come from a long line of heroes, so you must be heroes too. It erases all the complexity and ambiguity of history and leaves only the glory.
And finally, T for trauma. This feels like the most dangerous one in the current climate.
It is the fuel. It's the emotional engine. Galtung argued that when a chosen people suffer a trauma, the response isn't just to seek security. They seek punishment. They feel a deep need to reestablish their dominance and punish whoever they feel violated them.
And what is the trauma in 2026? What is the wound that Rubio is poking at?
Rubio spelled it out very clearly. The trauma of deindustrialization, the empty factories, the trauma of mass migration. He framed these not as economic trends or complex social issues, but as violations, as attacks. He talked about the fabric of society being torn.
That is language of injury.
Absolutely. And the response to injury in the CMT model is to lash out, to punish.
This leads to what Galtung called the gut brain.
Yes. This is such a great concept. Galtung theorized that nations, like people have a head brain, which is your rational logic, international law, diplomacy, cost-benefit analysis.
The prefrontal cortex.
Exactly. But they also have a gut brain, which is visceral, mythological, emotional, tribal. He argues that in times of rupture and trauma, the gut brain takes over foreign policy.
Is that why Rubio was almost bragging about the bombing runs? It felt so out of place in a diplomatic speech.
He listed them off like trophies. He said something like, 14 bombs dropped from B-2 bombers on Tehran. He mentioned special forces in Venezuela. He explicitly dismissed the role of the UN in those cases. Galtung would say that is the gut brain in action, pure and simple.
So the logic is, the chosen nation felt threatened by Iran or Venezuela, so it punished the transgressor.
And the head brain, things like the UN, treaties, international law, was just seen as an obstacle to that righteous punishment.
So when we see these sudden military strikes or these really harsh tariffs, we shouldn't necessarily be looking for the detailed economic logic. We should be looking for the emotional logic.
We should be looking for the story. Is this about restoring pride? Is this about avenging a trauma? Galtung also had this other concept he called isomorphism. It sounds biological.
Isomorphism. Break that down for us.
It just means same shape. Galtung argues that a superpower has a deep psychological need for the world to look like itself. It can't tolerate difference.
So it wants to remake the world in its own image.
Precisely. Notice that Rubio isn't just asking Europe to spend more on defense. He is demanding they adopt the American attitude of pride and reindustrialization. He wants them to mirror the U.S. self-image. He can't tolerate a partner that operates on a different operating system.
He wants a Europe that looks less like Brussels and more like Texas.
You couldn't have put it better.
Okay, so Galtung gives us the psychology. He explains the anger, the religious fervor, the need for enemies. But I want to go one level deeper now. I want to look at the machinery of this thinking. Because even someone like Mark Carney, who seems so rational, who isn't talking about divine providence, is still proposing massive military buildups and what he calls fortress economics. There's a common thread there.
This is where we have to turn to John McMurtry. And hold on to your hat, because if you thought Galtung was intense, McMurtry's analysis is desolate. He looks at what he calls the ruling group mind.
The group mind, it sounds like something out of science fiction, like a hive mind.
And it functions like one. McMurtry argues that the ruling structures of our society, government, corporations, the media, they all operate on a shared set of unspoken assumptions that actually block out reality.
How does that work?
He says it operates like a cognitive disorder.
Yeah.
It literally cannot see facts that contradict its core programming.
He uses 9/11 as his main case study, doesn't he?
He does. And just to be very clear, we are reporting his philosophical analysis here.
Mm-hmm.
He uses it as a structural example of how this group mind functions.
Understood.
McMurtry argues that during and after 9/11, the group mind automatically suppressed the forensic anomalies. You know, the standard intercept protocols for hijacked planes failing for over 70 minutes, the multiple warnings from foreign intelligence that were ignored.
But his main point isn't a conspiracy theory about the event itself. It's about the reaction to it.
It's all about the reaction, the blank check. He argues the event was immediately utilized to justify a pre-existing agenda, which was called full-spectrum dominance, the invasion of Iraq, the control of Central Asian oil and gas resources.
And the forensic question, cui bono, who benefits, was made taboo.
Completely taboo. You weren't allowed to ask it. If you asked who actually benefits from this war, you were branded a traitor or a crank. The group mind protects itself by pathologizing dissent.
Okay, and so how does this connect to Rubio and Carney here in 2026?
McMurtry would look at Rubio's restoration of Western industry and Carney's security of critical mineral supply chains and say, this is the exact same pattern. We are reframing a grab for resources, for lithium, for oil, for market share in the global South as a great moral crusade.
So Rubio calls it freedom or divine providence.
But the underlying logic, the operating system, is what McMurtry calls the money sequence.
Let's drill down on that, the money sequence. This feels like it's the core of his entire economic critique.
It is. It's a simple formula, and he argues it explains almost everything we see happening in the market. McMurtry says our current system is based on the sequence. Money goes to a commodity, which is then sold for more money.
So MCM prime.
Exactly. The goal of the system is to turn money into more money. The commodity, the thing you actually make, whether it's a car or a hospital service or a bomb, is just a middle step. It's just a means to an end.
And the end is always more capital accumulation.
Unlimited capital accumulation is the highest moral duty. That's the quote he uses from the philosopher Leo Strauss to describe this mindset. It's not just a business practice. It's a moral imperative.
But what's the alternative? I mean, that sounds like just business. Isn't that how the world works?
That's what the group mind wants you to think, that there is no alternative. But McMurtry says the alternative has always been there. He calls it the life sequence.
And that formula is.
Life goes to a means of life which leads to more life. In this sequence, the goal is to produce things that actually enable life to flourish. Breathable air, clean water, safe housing, knowledge, art. Money is just a tool to help facilitate that. It's not the goal.
Okay, I think I see the distinction. So, in the money sequence, if I cut down an ancient forest and sell the timber for a huge profit, GDP goes up. I have more money. The system says that's a success.
A huge success. You'd be on the cover of a business magazine.
But in the life sequence, I have just destroyed the means of life, the clean air, the biodiversity, the watershed. I have less life.
Exactly. Or another example. In the money sequence, a sick population is highly profitable because they buy a lot of drugs and hospital services. In the life sequence, a sick population is a catastrophic failure of the system.
And this brings us to McMurtry's most terrifying concept, what he calls the cancer stage of capitalism.
And he means that literally, doesn't he? It's not just a catchy, angry metaphor for him.
He insists it is a strict structural diagnosis. Think about what cancer actually is in a biological body. It is a group of cells that begins to multiply without limit. It disconnects from the homeostatic, the immune system of the host body, and it just grows for its own sake.
It consumes the host's resources to fuel its own endless growth. And in the process, it eventually kills the host that it depends on.
And McMurtry is saying our global economy is doing that to the planet.
He says the money sequence has become carcinogenic. It is growing for the sake of growth, completely ignoring the health of the life capital, the biosphere, the social fabric that actually supports it.
So when Rubio complains about the climate cult holding back the economy,
In McMurtry's view, that is the cancer, complaining that the host body is trying to stop it from feeding. Rubio wants to unleash the energy sector, which is another way of saying unleash the growth, regardless of the biological cost to the host.
but what about Carney? This is the tricky one. Carney is the green guy. He's the former head of the Bank of England. He's Mr. Climate Finance. He's talking about sustainability.
And that's what makes this so insidious from McMurtry's perspective. Carney is trying to manage the risk. He's investing in clean tech. He wants green bonds. But look at his methods: cutting taxes on capital gains, fast-tracking $1 trillion in private investment, getting pension funds to seek higher returns in green infrastructure.
He's still using all the tools of the money sequence.
McMurtry would argue that Carney is trying to feed the cancer sustainably. He's trying to find a green way for the tumor to keep growing. He's prioritizing the financial resilience of the system, making sure the banks don't collapse over the actual resilience of the collective life capital.
Is digging up the Arctic for critical minerals to build electric cars really the life sequence?
Or is it just feeding the same industrial machine a different kind of food? That's the question he would ask.
It really challenges our definition of rationality. We assume Carney is being rational because he uses big words and wears a suit and talks about risk horizons and balancing budgets.
But McMurtry redefines the system's rationality as self-maximizing choice. In our system, it is considered rational to destroy the climate if it maximizes your quarterly return on investment.
And McMurtry would say that isn't rationality.
He'd call it collective madness. It is functionally insane to systematically destroy your own habitat, no matter how much money you make in the process.
So we have the diagnosis. The patient, our civilization, is in a state of rupture, as Carney says. It's being driven by a psychotic break of myths and trauma, according to Galtung. And it's suffering from a systemic cancer, if you listen to McMurtry. It's a pretty grim picture for 2026.
It is. It's a very heavy diagnosis. But knowing the diagnosis is the only way you can even begin to talk about a cure. And both sides are proposing treatments.
Okay, so let's look at the solutions on the table. Path A seems to be the fortress.
This is the emerging Carney-Rubio consensus. And it's fascinating because despite their wildly different styles, they basically agree on this. The world is dangerous, resources are scarce, so we have to build walls.
Rubio wants a hard fortress.
A hard fortress, yes.
Yeah.
Made of guns, oil, and God.
And Carney wants a smart fortress.
A smart fortress made of technology, shifting alliances, and sovereign supply chains. But the principle is the same. It's about securing the money sequence for our side against the other guys.
It's a world of competitive survival. I need that lithium for my electric car battery, so I'm going to make a deal to get it, and I'll put my navy there to protect it.
Peace through strength. That's the mantra for both of them, just expressed in different languages.
Okay, so that's path A, the fortress. What is path B? What does the McMurtry life sequence solution actually look like on the ground?
Path B is the civil commons.
Define that for us, because it's not a term you hear every day.
The civil commons are all the things that we as a society have built together that serve life directly, not profit.
Yeah.
Universal healthcare is a perfect example. Public libraries, clean water systems, the fire department, public parks and sidewalks.
So all the things we usually take for granted until they're gone. The things that make life livable but don't necessarily make a billionaire rich.
Exactly. These are our collective life capital. McMurtry argues that the only real solution is to aggressively expand this sector. And he has some very specific proposals, like public banking.
He mentioned North Dakota, of all places.
Bank of North Dakota. It's a state-owned public bank that has been supporting the local economy for over a century. He also cites post-war Japan and modern China. The idea is that credit money should be created by public institutions to build things people actually need, like housing, bridges, and hospitals, not for private banks to fuel speculation in stocks or real estate.
So money itself would become a public utility, like water or electricity.
Precisely. He also calls for ecological quotas.
Rationing. That's a very dirty word in modern politics.
It is. It terrifies people. But his logic is pretty stark. If you have a cancerous tumor, you don't just tax its blood supply to try and discourage it. You cut off the blood supply.
So you stop feeding it.
You stop feeding it. McMurtry suggests we need to strictly limit the consumption of non-renewable resources. Not tax them, but put a hard cap on them. And then, in exchange for that limit, provide a citizen income for people who do work that actually serves life care work, education, ecological restoration.
It's a complete inversion of Rubio's worldview. Rubio wants to unleash industrial power at all costs. McMurtry wants to harness and limit industrial power to serve life.
And that is the fundamental clash in 2026. Rubio says the climate cult will make us poor. McMurtry says the money cult will make us extinct.
And Mark Carney is standing there in the middle, trying to build a wind turbine on top of a nuclear submarine.
That's a perfect image for it, trying to save the planet while simultaneously preparing for a war over its last resources.
It brings me back to that quote Carney used in his speech. He was quoting Havel again. He said, "The powerful have their power, but we have the capacity to stop pretending."
It's a great line. It sounds so rebellious and truthful.
But after this entire conversation, I have to ask, are we stopping the real pretense? We stopped pretending that globalization was one big happy family. Okay, great. The sign is down from the grocer's window.
Right.
But are we now pretending that reindustrialization and building these fortresses and preparing for warfare can somehow save us from the ecological reality McMurtry is talking about?
That is the $1 trillion question. We might just be trading one lie for a much more dangerous, more violent one. We might be trading the lie of global peace for the lie of national salvation, while the underlying cancer just keeps growing, now wrapped in a flag.
McMurtry had this haunting quote. I think he said it was an old indigenous saying that I think sums this whole dilemma up better than any policy paper ever could.
I know the one you mean.
When all the trees have been cut down, when all the rivers have been poisoned, when all the fish have been caught, only then will you discover you cannot eat money.
You can't eat money. It just cuts through all the complexity, doesn't it?
It really does. All the variable geometry and all the divine providence in the world won't matter if the basic life sequence breaks. If the water isn't drinkable, the stock market value of the water utility company is completely irrelevant.
It's just numbers on a screen.
So a final thought for you, the listener. As you watch the news this week, as you see the fleets moving and the tariffs rising and the politicians giving these grand speeches, maybe try to look for the civil commons in your own life. The library, the public park, the clean water that comes out of your tap.
Because that might be where the real value, the real wealth, is hiding in plain sight.
And ask yourself, is the new sign they're putting in the window any truer than the old one? Or are we just getting better at pretending?
A heavy thought to end on.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
A pleasure as always.
Stay curious.